Thank you. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This 26th day of July, 2023. We have two cases on our calendar for oral argument this morning. The first is State of Minnesota versus Giannis. We are ready for argument. Would appellant's counsel please approach the podium, introduce yourself for the record before beginning your argument.
Thank you, Your Honors. Thank you. My name is Michael Padden. I represent the appellant in this matter. This is an appeal from a criminal conviction in Washington County. And I think it presents a couple of very interesting issues. The first one concerns the contention that I was not the trial attorney, as you know, that there was a failure to provide a complete disclosure for a witness whose name was Youssef. And because of that, the trial judge determined that this witness was very hampered in terms of what he could testify to. Namely, that he was limited to, in essence, rebuttal testimony. I mean, I guess in the defense case, all the defense witnesses are arguably rebuttal, but that he could only say that the alleged victim, a woman with the initials ES, could testify that she gave, that this woman gave him a phone number to give to the defendant. The problem with that, Your Honors, was that the gravamen of the case came down to whether the sexual intercourse was consensual. And because of the failure of defense counsel to provide a full disclosure, this witness could not provide substantive testimony to the jury that he knew, had personal knowledge, that they had a prior relationship, something that ES denied when she testified in the state's case in chief.
Counsel, I don't really understand how the failure to disclose this information was prejudicial when the district court judge ruled that the substance of that testimony was just plainly inadmissible under the rules of evidence.
Yeah.
So where's the prejudice?
I think that's a mistake.
And you're not challenging that ruling on appeal.
Well, I think she's wrong, but I don't know how she could make a ruling like that, frankly. One of the things that
he was going to talk about prior sexual experience, and there's rules and statutes that prohibit that information from being disclosed to trial.
I think, Your Honor, though, when it comes to, I know the rape shield laws, but when it comes to the issue of whether the specific person charged had a prior consensual relationship with the victim, then I believe that is, in fact, admissible. I think there's something I need to say to address that. My perception of this case, and I certainly gleaned this from conversations with my attorney and just everything I learned about the case. And again, I guess I have a little bit of a disadvantage in the sense that I wasn't a trial attorney. But I really think this judge, and I respect this judge completely. She's an excellent judge. I've had many experiences with her in the past. I think she's retired now. But there seemed to be a real substantive dislike of this defendant. I don't know why that is, but I just think that the dislike she had for this man tainted her objectivity, you know, which perhaps, if you don't mind, leads to the second issue. As a trial attorney who's tried over 120 cases to verdict in my career, I've been practicing law for 36 years. I'm no young spring chicken. I really understand jury trials. I don't know how a judge, and if a juror on a panel blurts out something negative about the defendant, how can you possibly not grant the request for a mistrial, which was correctly made by defense counsel? A corrective instruction at that point was just not going to be good enough. In fact, she blurted out not only that she had heard that the defendant had groped someone, she didn't say defendant. I want to be clear about that. She said the owner of the shop, which was in fact the defendant, had groped a woman. And then secondly, that she heard that he had tax issues.
Counsel, I didn't see a transcript of this exchange in the record. How are we supposed to review it without a transcript?
Your Honor, I submitted an affidavit. I don't know what I can do. I tried to submit everything that was taken down by the court. But
was voir dire not recorded by the
court? I don't believe it was, no, strangely. So I guess I have to tell you, I really think, you know, I realize a lot of the times when it comes down to criminal appeals, you're dealing with some mundane issues. I think this case really represents for the court some really important issues and a chance to, you know, to not only corroborate the law that exists, but perhaps make some new law. I just think on these two issues, they really are good, viable issues. And it's time, I think, to give a message to district court judges that when a juror on a panel blurts out something negative like that, I mean, it's a no-brainer. You got to grant a mistrial. I've actually had this happen once in my career. Many years ago, I was trying a civil case, jury trial. We were in jury selection. My opponent was a prominent lawyer with a big personal injury firm. I was doing insurance defense at the time. And a juror said negative things about the attorney in jury selection, just kind of blurted it out. Everybody was really shocked, which I think was the situation here, that everybody was shocked when that happened. When Cascarano made his oral argument on this, he pointed out that he was shocked, and everybody was shocked in the courtroom and the case at hand. And when it happened in that case, I can't remember who my trial judge was. It might have been Judge Schuffelbein from many, many years ago, who's been retired for many years. And he immediately granted the request of plaintiff's counsel for a mistrial. I mean, it just was a no-brainer. We had to bring up a new panel. So, Your Honors, I think my brief is rather pointed and to the point. I don't want to insult your intelligence by repeating what's in there. Unless you have any additional questions, that's really all I have to say. So I hope I'm not being disrespectful by having brevity.
So. Not at all.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honors.
Now we'll hear from counsel for the state of Minnesota. Please introduce yourself for the record before beginning your argument.
Thank you, and good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Nick Hajdukovic. I'm an assistant Washington County attorney, and I represent the respondent, state of Minnesota. The state is asking that this court affirm the appellant's conviction for third-degree criminal sexual conduct. Trial counsel was not ineffective, certainly not to a constitutional level of deficiency, nor was any conduct prejudicial, when he made a strategic decision, and frankly a sound one, to keep certain evidence close to the vest so that he could surprise the state with it at trial. And then secondly, the district court did not abuse its considerable discretion when denying the motion for a mistrial during voir dire.
Can I ask about that second issue? Sure. Was voir dire recorded?
Yes. As far as I can tell, yes, it was, but the transcript was not ordered by the appellant.
Do you dispute that a veneer member said, in the presence of the other veneer members, that she had heard the owner of this business had groped another woman?
I don't dispute that, Your Honor. I think we're simply limited to the record we have in front of us with counsel's descriptions of the event rather than the event itself. But everybody seemed to agree at the time that it had happened. We don't have any details other than what counsel said, and I think we're stuck with that for the purposes of this appeal.
Do you see any problem with that? Doesn't that pollute the panel?
So substantively, it had the potential to, but under the facts of this case, it did not.
Why is that?
Well, again, we have to look at the Cox factors as I set forth in my brief, and the first of those factors is the nature and source of the extraneous information that's brought before the jury. And here, of course, the source of the information is a potential juror who ends up not serving on the jury. And that doesn't mean it's completely insignificant, but it stands in stark contrast to the Cox case, where the source of the information was a licensed peace officer who was also the bailiff in this case, in charge of the courtroom and the jury, who gave essentially his opinion that once the state rests its case, in his mind, it was all over. And I think that's a far more problematic statement, especially when we look at the rest of the factors here, than what we have in this situation, where we don't have anybody with the general authority that society would give to a law enforcement officer, much less the law enforcement officer actually entrusted with the jury and the courtroom as a bailiff is. Who I think might even have it, you know, be seen by the jurors as even more authoritative potentially. And in Cox, of course, the Supreme Court still affirmed the conviction despite that extremely inappropriate comment by the bailiff. Here, the nature of the information that was brought before the jury is perhaps unique. I didn't find any cases like this where there are cases where jurors blurt things out, But here we have the potential prejudicial, very prejudicial information about the owner of the smoke shop groping a woman over her clothing was actually presented as evidence in the trial, legitimately as Spriegel evidence. A witness testified.
So the very incident that the veneer member mentioned was admitted as Spriegel evidence.
Correct. I can't say for sure that it's the same incident, but it certainly matched the description in a lot of and frankly went into much more detail than the juror did. And also, obviously, was subject to cross-examination, and that cross-examination was lengthy and vigorous by defense counsel. So this is an unusual situation where it appears the prejudicial information was also brought out legitimately with the opportunity for cross-examination, so the jurors could actually evaluate the details of it. And as I'll get to in a moment, they also did agree that they would set aside what the juror had said, but they didn't have to rely on the juror's second or third hand information. That's frankly pretty vague.
So on the Spriegel, did the actual complaining witness testify? This happened to me.
Correct. That's exactly what happened, and she testified in a lot of detail. It was a lengthy direct and cross-examination about what the appellant had done and its similarity to the victim of the charged offense. And I would note that the appellant hasn't challenged whether that Spriegel evidence was properly admitted either. So it appears that the evidence the juror was referring to was actually properly admitted through all the legitimate means, which, to the extent there was prejudice, I think would greatly reduce the unfairness of that prejudice because the jurors got to hear it from the complaining witness herself, subject to cross-examination, exactly how the jury is supposed to get its information. The other factors include the number of jurors who heard the remark. The record doesn't definitively tell us that all 12 jurors heard the remark. The juror who made the remark obviously was struck for cause. But even if we assume, because, I mean, all the jurors were present in the courtroom at the time, we can presume, even if we assume that all 12 heard the comment by the jurors, the court has noted previously that factor is not dispositive. In the McFatridge case, which is a non-precedential case I discussed in my brief because it was the most factually similar one I could find, 11 of the 12 jurors in that case had heard the comment by a juror that the defendant had assaulted that juror's child. This court said, well, that one factor may weigh in favor of reversal. When looked at in the rest of the context, the court still affirmed. The third factor is the strength of the evidence that was legitimately presented. And obviously, as I've discussed, we have the actual testimony of the person who was groped over her clothing by the appellant. But we also have a strong case regarding the actual charged conduct. In terms of the victim of that conduct, testified at great length and in great detail about what the appellant had done before, during, and after the sexual assault. We have the victim sending a text to a friend, including a picture of the appellant, within minutes of being sexually assaulted, and those were admitted as exhibits into evidence, in which the victim said in the text message to the friend within minutes, I just got raped, essentially. And then we have consistent statements made to the responding police officer, to a sexual assault nurse, to a detective later on, and all of those were consistent with her trial testimony. We have DNA evidence from a cervical swab taken from the victim during the sexual assault examination that had appellant's DNA on it. And then finally, again, we have that Spriegel evidence where the victim in that case testified, again, in great length and at great detail about appellant doing something very similar to her in the same place. And luckily, she was able to end that situation before it escalated to the sexual penetration that was involved with the victim in the charged case here that was on trial. So that factor, I think, weighs very strongly, perhaps even decisively, in favor of affirmance here because of the strength of the evidence. And again, the fact that the jury heard all the details from the complainant herself in the regarding the juror's comment. And then the final factor is sort of the effectiveness of the limiting instructions. And what I'd note with regard to that is Well, defense counsel did ask for a mistrial, and I'm not making any waiver claim here. He did ultimately agree to the language in the limiting instruction once Judge Moss stated, well, I'm not going to declare a mistrial. I'm going to give a curative instruction. So they discussed how it should be worded, and defense counsel was in agreement with that, which I think just demonstrates that it was, although not the remedy he wanted, given that the court's ruling, it was agreeable to the defense. All the jurors agreed that they could set the remark aside, and I think the instruction was pretty unequivocal, basically saying this is hearsay within hearsay. It's second or third-hand information from a friend of a friend. It's not evidence. You cannot consider it. You know, is everybody able to set that aside and just base this case on what you hear from the witnesses? And they all said, yes, they were. So it would seem that that's as effective as you can get. And I would also note that Judge Moss made certain observations of the jurors during this discussion that haven't been challenged here on appeal, where she talked about, where she said, we've all been impressed with their ability to keep a fair and impartial mind, where she said counsel had plumbed the depth of their collective consciousness to see if they can be fair in this jury, and I think they can. That's in the transcript at pages 38 to 39 of the trial. Judge Moss, I think, made those observations. She was in the best position to do so, certainly more than any of us, especially without a transcript of the voir dire. We have no way to look behind those statements, but we also have no reason to doubt them. Counsel at the time didn't dispute that, and neither does counsel here on appeal. So I wanted to emphasize a few other things in terms of what the case is not about today. With regard to the ineffective assistance claim, as the court brought up with counsel, appellate counsel has not challenged Judge Moss's conclusion that the evidence that this witness, Mr. Youssef, didn't testify to was inadmissible. Counsel sort of claimed to challenge it today, but that was never done in the brief, nor was it done at the post-conviction stage, and this was the issue on post-conviction, was the ineffective assistance of counsel issue that this court stayed the appeal for. So that hasn't been raised before. There hasn't been any challenge to that conclusion, and I think even if we were to look under the hood of that, it's clearly correct. The witness summary that was not disclosed to the state strategically is part of the record. I believe it's attached to Mr. Padden's affidavit, and that he submitted at the post-conviction stage. And just reading through that, essentially, D.Y., Mr. Youssef, testified to everything in that witness summary that would have been admissible under any reasonable reading of the rules of evidence in terms of what he had personal knowledge of. The rest of it was essentially speculation on his part. And there's, again, no challenge to Judge Moss's conclusion that it was, but even if we do look at that, it seems pretty clearly correct. The case is also not about judicial bias. There's been no claim made before today that Judge Moss was in any way biased, and obviously that's a very tough hill to climb for someone to claim that the judge was so biased, and there's really no evidence to support that. The appellant had a fair trial, and the state simply presented a very strong case. So with those thoughts in mind, Your Honor, I don't have anything further unless the court has additional questions. All right. Thank you, Your Honors. I thank the court.
Thank you. Mr. Padden, would you like to make some comments on rebuttal?
Just a few comments, Your Honors. In a case like this, where you know from the state's disclosures that the victim, or at the time alleged victim, was going to claim that there was no prior consensual sexual relationship, it's a lawyering 101. If you have an employee that knew about the relationship, that worked in the smoke shop, that you let the state know is going to testify that they had a prior consensual relationship, which goes to the heart of the credibility of the victim, you disclose that right away, like within 30 days of the time you're retained. Why do you do that? Because you're jockeying, you know, to hopefully get a fair offer from the state. So it's just shocking to me that you have a witness is going to testify. Now, whether ultimately it might not have been admissible, I don't know about that. I mean, I guess you can argue that until the cows come home. But in a situation like that, you really have to get that out there front and center and disclose it. this was an experienced criminal defense attorney. He made a mistake. He didn't provide a full and in fact, at one point he claimed that he never had any contact with this witness, but his investigator did. So I think that was a clear mistake on his part. If that went into evidence, it would have clearly could have made a difference in the result. I think I'd like to say to you, Your Honors, that I just tried a case in Hennepin County, a second-degree murder case where I secured an acquittal. And in that case, the key witness for the state was a young woman like this case, and her credibility was addressed and assessed throughout the course of the trial and in cross-examination. The jury in that case came back with a not guilty verdict. So,
counsel, can I just
sure.
Since you're talking about cross-examination, I want to ask about the mistrial claim.
Sure.
What do you make of the state's argument that any prejudice to the defendant was blunted by the fact that AF testified at trial and was, as I'm looking at the transcript right here, really subject to robust cross-examination about the very subject that was the outburst was about?
Potentially, but I mean, the jury could have thought, or the potential jurors could have thought, maybe this is somebody else. You know, maybe there's another situation where a woman was groped. We don't know for sure. And then secondly, the witness blurted out the tax cheat thing. So it's not just the notion that he groped somebody, but the tax cheat thing. I mean, that, you know, that's really, you know, how do you even address that? I mean, it's, you know, I think the typical American doesn't like the idea that someone's cheating on their taxes, you know. So it's just, it's hard to know specifically, but it just, I think the fact that... I just think the typical judge in a situation like that just would have knee-jerk granted a mistrial and brought up a new panel. And I think the fact that the judge didn't do that is indicative of the fact that this judge, and, you know, I didn't really address this in my brief, but I'm just telling you from my intuitive perspective, when you look at this entire record, I just think Judge Moss did not like this guy. You know, maybe it was the nature of the charge. I don't know what it was. But I just think the typical district court judge in a situation like that, I mean, I know the judge I had in Hennepin County for that murder case last month. I guarantee you that judge would have granted a mistrial if something like that happened in jury selection. Now, it's a different kind of a case. I know it's a murder case, but it's a serious felony case like this one was. So I think these are interesting issues, Your Honors. I think they're viable. I think this man is entitled to relief, and I'm hopeful that you'll give these issues strong consideration. Thank you.
I thank you both for your briefing and your arguments. The matter is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days.